When I sent it off to the editor the first time, I was kind of terrified about what I'd get back because I had no idea what they'd be like. So there is something quite exposing about that, which feeds in, I think, to feeling like a, you know, fear of mistakes. But I think you just need to give yourself permission to just accept that you will write something not very good one day. But also, it might actually be much better than you think, and often it will. And actually having something down is better than still thinking about how you're going to put something on the page.
Hello, it's Steph, and welcome to episode 54 of the Creating Happy Writers podcast. Thank you for joining me today. Whether it's your first time or you've been here a while, your support is so appreciated. I'm a multi-published author and a writing coach on a mission to take away the overwhelm, confusion, and frustration from the writing process and give you the confidence and knowledge you need to pursue your writing goals. If you want to get even more support from me, head on over to Substack, where you can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter all about writing and publishing. You can find me at stephcaswell.substack.com. You can also get a copy of my book, Dare to Write, which takes you all the way from your initial idea to published manuscript. It's at stephcaswell.com/shop and on Amazon. And finally, if you're ready to write your book, come and join my group program, Foundations, which teaches you the three fundamentals you need for writing nonfiction: confidence in your concept, certainty as to who your ideal reader is, and clarity on your structure. Without these three foundational pillars, nonfiction books are so much harder to write. And as you know, I'm all about bringing in more ease and simplicity to the writing process. So why not come and join a fabulous group of women who are all on the same journey as you are? I'd love to have you there. The next cohort starts in May and the waiting list is now open. All the links are in the show notes. Right, let's crack on with today's episode, shall we? It's another guest episode, and this time I'm talking to the very talented Dr. Emma Hepburn. Dr. Emma Hepburn is a clinical psychologist with expertise in neuropsychology. She has over 20 years' experience of working with and treating mental health difficulties and working with brain conditions in both the NHS and the private sector. Her work aims to bring psychology and evidence-based mental health information beyond the clinic room to a wider audience and encourage people to proactively look after their mental health. She shares her illustrations and discusses brain functioning, mental health, well-being and psychology at The Psychology Mum on Instagram. Emma is the author of four books: A Toolkit for Modern Life, A Toolkit for Happiness, A Toolkit for Your Emotions, and a free ebook, How to Stay Calm in a Global Pandemic, that can be shared, printed, and downloaded by anyone. She has also developed an emotional first aid kit with 45 illustrated cards to help you look after your well-being. Her work has been featured by organisations around the world, including the BBC, HuffPost, The Sunday Telegraph, and Psychology's magazine. Emma has been shortlisted for a Mind Media Award and was awarded the Points of Light Award by the Prime Minister for her contribution to public mental health during the pandemic, including her free ebook. Emma's current role in the NHS is as lead for the Staff Wellbeing Programme. She is also an honorary senior lecturer at the University of Aberdeen, where she lectures on mental health and wellbeing in the workplace. She has worked with people and organisations around the world to help them put wellbeing at the heart of their organisations and lives. During our conversation, we talk about Emma's author journey, including her experience of working with one of the big five publishers, Hachette, and why she believes that great books come from having a great team around you, why we can struggle with imposter syndrome as writers and often don't even call ourselves authors despite having written several books. We also chat about the opportunities that being an author has given her, helping her spread her message further, and why timing played a part in the success of her first book. March 2020, anyone? Finally, Emma and I chat about how she managed to fit in writing during the years of COVID, particularly when working for the NHS, and the different experiences she had writing each of her books when it came to time management. This is such a wonderful conversation, and Emma is such a wonderful, wonderful person to listen to. I first came across her when I read her column in Psychology's magazine, and I was absolutely thrilled that she agreed to be on the podcast. So enjoy the conversation. I hope you love listening to it as much as I loved having it. So I'd love it if you could just start by telling us how you got to be a published author, the journey from, you know, sort of those initial stages right through to now obviously being a multi-published author.
Yeah, so I mean, I probably thinking back to our 20s or 30s, never really imagined being an author. I would have loved to have been, but couldn't see how to get there. So I worked as a psychologist, or still work as a psychologist in the NHS, a clinical psychologist. And I guess that has been my passion and is my passion for many years, of trying to make things as accessible and understandable and usable as possible. And I do that within my clinical work by kind of sharing images, sharing, trying to make what can be quite wordy psychological theory usable to people, so they can go away with something and really take it and use it. And then I started, I basically bought myself an iPad because I asked my husband for one for my birthday and didn't get one. So I bought myself one and saw an iPad pen. I thought, oh, that might be good. And started drawing these out a bit better for people. And I thought, well, you know, I'm using these with individuals, but actually we could all benefit from improving our knowledge about what mental health is. There's a lot of myths and stigma out there. So I started sharing it on social media, having no knowledge of social media whatsoever, and actually been quite frightened of it. I had my own account, which had like 3 people on it, my family, and I had absolutely no knowledge. So I started sharing these, and people just really engaged with them. They just really enjoyed the images, but also I was writing about what the images meant and how they could use them alongside it. And this grew and grew. And I was contacted by a publisher to say, would you be interested in writing a book? And at that point, I was actually doing a neuropsychology qualification because I was working with the brain and neuropsychology. So I had absolutely no capacity. And, you know, this was like, I had no anticipation of this whatsoever. So it was really exciting, but also I just had no capacity. So I had to say, can we, you know, look at this again, maybe in a few months? So we did, and we talked about what a book would be and how that might work. And and I appreciate, I'm very, very lucky in how that happened, and it was probably not anticipated, and that's where the books came from. And the first one, I was actually thinking about today, I think I finished it exactly 4 years ago today. Not all the edits, but the actual writing of the book, I'm pretty sure, looking at the dates, it was 4 years ago today I finished it. And that was pre-pandemic. So it was a point where we were, probably thinking, is this pandemic thing going to be significant? Is it going to be over shortly? A lot of uncertainty. And I had written in my book something about in the recent pandemic. And I remember the editor saying, based on what we knew at the time, now this book comes out in September, it might not be relevant then. And I agreed, and we did put some reference to it, but we weren't sure kind of how relevant it would be. And then obviously the pandemic hit, much worse, I think, than anybody expected. And the book came out during the pandemic in September. And I, at that point, everybody, I think we'd got over that kind of initial kind of, oh, this is going to be over by summer. We're all going to be back out, to thinking, how long will this be going on? And there was suggestions of other lockdowns, and people were feeling quite bad generally. And lots of people were talking about mental health. And my book happened to come into that space, which I think it was also really, it's not a tome. It's not a big lengthy book around wellbeing and mental health. It's kind of, it's a really serious subject. But it's quite a lighthearted book because it's got lots of, you know, I illustrate it as well. It's got lots of characters in it. It's got, I talk about the brain like Beyonce, you know. So it's easy to read. And I think that's what people needed at that time. They needed a book which had evidence-based content, but was, you know, easy to read when you were feeling rubbish, basically, which was the idea behind the book. But I could never have predicted it would come out at a time when that's just what people needed. And it just kind of went from there. And I guess that kind of, you know, comes back to, I feel really lucky in kind of what's happened. But also, I think luck plays such a major element of when a book happens to come out, fits in a kind of zeitgeist, or if it fits in kind of, you know, what's going on at the time. So I think, you know, that had a major impact. I can take no responsibility for that. And obviously I would have rather we didn't go through that, and we'd rather people weren't having those difficult times. But it obviously just hit at that right time for people.
Yeah. I think what I also think is so important for people is that I think psychology and understanding mental health is quite a saturated space now. I think there's lots of people talking about it. But what I love about what you do and I love about your books is that they're just that little bit different, that they make it so much more user-friendly. And I think that's what the USP is that it's just, like you said, it's like having that more playful side to it, which you don't often see, particularly around topics like that, where you can still give people such great information, great strategies. And like you say, it's a toolkit, right? So people can actually take away things and use it, but it's done in a way that is so, yeah, unique. It's that brilliant way that you've decided to give us that information, which is, I think, yeah, okay, luck for sure has to have a part of it in terms of what we've just been through. But at the same time, I also think that the way you do it and how brilliantly you deliver it is a big part of it too.
No, thank you very much. Although I'm a Scottish person, so I don't take compliments very readily or easily. So I appreciate that. And I think, you know, that was kind of the whole aim behind it. Because, you know, you're seeing people in a clinic, and I've seen thousands of people in a clinic, and it's really hard to take information in and use it when it's really dense and wordy. But also a lot of the information out there is actually not evidence-based. And that kind of people are doing things sometimes which are unhelpful to their mental health. So I kind of combine those two, I guess, frustrations really. Frustrations that I want people to have accessible, usable stuff that they can really just, you know, think of, oh, I'm going to use this now. And so it all came from kind of, you know, clinical work and frustrations around clinical work, but also seeing, you know, how, so some of the concepts in my first book came from a brain injury group I did, and we had these big posters up on the wall, which I started drawing a bit nicer once I got my iPad. And people were like, oh, I just remembered the capacity cup, which was one we had up on the wall. And I just, so, you know, instead of becoming really frustrated, or I just thought, oh, my capacity is full, I need to do something about it now. So you could see how useful they were and how people could really just, instead of having to remember, and obviously the writing's a really critical part to explain it, but the illustrations are the thing that people just remember. They just think, ah, yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we underestimate how simplifying things just through pictures and diagrams, and especially diagrams that are done in that slightly kind of there's just such I was having a look at some of them when I was thinking of what I wanted to talk to you about, and I was going onto your Instagram, and you know, it's brilliant artwork, but I love the playfulness around it, and I think that's what sticks in people's minds. I said I loved the ones that were the self-stigma ghosts and the catastrophizing cats, because I just thought It's so simple in one way. Obviously, that what's behind it isn't simple, but the way you're able to simplify it is what resonates for people, because they know that there is obviously depth to what you're talking about, but to be able to take it in this way where you, like you say, it's memorable and there's a playful side to it is, I think, what makes it work so brilliantly. I'd just be interested to know because people that listen to the podcast are often at the beginning of their journeys of writing and publishing, and they're trying to consider whether they go down a traditional publishing route or whether they self-publish. And there's often people who are sort of very firmly in one or other, or they're still not sure. How did you find working with a big publisher? Because, I mean, Hachette are, you know, a big publisher. I know that it's one of the imprints that, you know, your book comes under, but actually the overarching group is Hachette. And I just wondered, how did they feel about this slightly playful approach, the kind of the idea of using illustration? Were they open to that, or was that something that you had to discuss?
Well, again, I was incredibly lucky that they approached me with the idea of writing a book. So that was what, and I also, again, in terms of timing, a new imprint was coming in, which was illustrated, an illustrated imprint. I'm not sure if that's the right term, but it was, so they were looking for illustrated work with written content. So again, timings worked incredibly well, and I have found them incredibly supportive. I think for me, knowing nothing, to be quite frank, about the publishing industry, I am not sure I could have set myself deadlines. I could have kind of given myself a structure, or I would have even known where to go with it. So I've huge, I'm struggling for words today. I have huge admiration for people who self-publish, because I think that's, you know, and I can see why beneficial it is. But for somebody who knew nothing about the industry, having that supportive team round about me, tell me what would work in publishing, what wouldn't work, but also being really respectful of my content that I was putting in. So if I, you know, very much seeing me as the expert in psychology, but me very much seeing them as the experts in publishing, because I don't know that. And I know a lot more now, 4 years down the line, but I knew nothing then. So I have to say I had a really, really positive experience. And for me, I think having those deadlines, having things to work towards, because I was doing quite limited time as well, because I still work in the NHS, was hugely beneficial to me. So I can't really comment on the self-publishing side, because, for me personally, I'm not sure I could have done that, because it would have taken me so much effort to work out how where to go with that. So can't come to both sides, but I had a very positive experience.
Yeah, no, that's really helpful. Yeah, I think it's difficult because, like you say, when you've not had any experience with the publishing world, it's such a new kind of, in some ways it's a very frustrating industry because it's quite slow sometimes, and they like to stick to the way they've always done things. And I think that was probably why I was really interested to know how the partnership had felt around, you know, things like illustrations. But I mean, it sounds like that, like you say, perfect timing. In fact, they were actively looking for that kind of content. But I also think that you're right about the team approach. Like, you're the expert in what you do, and they're the expert in what they do. And it's almost like finding that middle ground as to what feels right for you, the creator, to put into the book, but also for them to know actually, well, what's going to hit the market, what's going to make sense to the people wanting to read it. I think what I wanted to ask you a little bit around, I guess you're obviously so knowledgeable around the psychology part of it, and I thought it'd be remiss of me not to ask you about some of the things that could possibly help writers. I know you talk a bit about imposter syndrome and making mistakes and things like that. Did you find that when you were writing that you felt an element of imposter syndrome? And if you did, or, you know, if you can imagine people that do, what sort of things would help get rid of that or help manage it at least?
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, just about everybody feels imposter syndrome. And I think for me, I only just changed my name on my bio on social media and LinkedIn to author this year. So there's something interesting for me that I felt comfortable because I had a qualification, call myself a clinical psychologist, but I never called myself an author. And then my husband said, "You've got 3 books, Emma. You need to call yourself an author." So I've claimed that title. So I think I felt an imposter as an author, and I kind of clung on to, but I've got expertise in psychology. So I guess that probably helped me through it. If I write a nonfiction book ever, who knows what I'll do? I won't have that crutch, I guess. But I think I've noticed myself through the journey, part of it was that kind of fear of making mistakes, and we all have that. So I probably, for the first book, wrote 2 books. I wrote far too much, and I tried, because I had no idea kind of how long things would take or what you're expected to send through to the editor. I'd spent ages honing it down, trying to make it perfect. And then I realized that actually you just need to write and just get it down and get something down, and it will be imperfect and it will be rubbish and it actually doesn't matter. But also the times that you think you've probably written the most rubbish, you'll go back and look at them and they'll actually be really good, because when you're in the middle of it, you just cannot see, you know, if something is really good or not. So there's some things, I mean, I remember sitting in the garden in, I think it was for the second book I wrote, and thinking, right, I've got half an hour before the kids come home. I'm just going to blast something out. It doesn't matter what it's like. And I think that's what's quite freeing, saying, doesn't matter what it's like. Doesn't matter if it's rubbish. And I just blasted something down. And I almost wrote a whole chapter. And it's one of my favourite chapters of the book. But it's because I think I'd taken that pressure off myself and just allowing myself to say, look, just write something. I think we spend so long trying to think about what we'll write and trying to get it right. Well, I certainly did in the first book. or the third book, I was like, I just need to get this down and then I can make it better. But if I've got a blank page, there's nothing for me to make better. I can't make a blank page better in my imagination, but I can make what I've got down on paper better and just getting it done. And I always felt better once I had something on paper. Even if it was cut, you know, later on, it was still there. I'd done it. So I think it's just saying it's not going to be perfect. And I think if we get so caught up in thinking it must be really good. And there's something quite exposing about sending it off to an editor. Now, the first book, I was kind of terrified when I sent it off to the editor the first time about what I'd get back, because I had no idea what they'd be like. So there is something quite exposing about that, which feeds in, I think, to feeling like a, you know, fear of mistakes. But I think you just need to give yourself permission to just accept that you will write something not very good one day, but also it might actually be much better than you think, and often it will. And actually having something down is better than still thinking about how you're going to put something on the page. So I got better at that as I've gone on. But the first book, I used to sit for ages and construct a chapter and then change it, and I still have a blank page in front of me. So it's been a real learning process.
Yeah, I think you're so right. That was the same for me with my first book. I remember I was trying the whole time to write and edit at the same time. So I'd write a piece and then I'd try and edit it, and I'd be like, no, this, and I'd delete the whole section or whatever and think, no, I got, and it was the most frustrating thing. And I can't remember who I was listening to or, you know, what it was exactly, but it was somebody who basically said, you just need to write, just write, stop reading back your work. And now I say this to people quite often, or the authors that I work with, when they can't quite believe me when I say I don't read anything back until the end. So the first draft, so I just write. I might read back the last sentence or something from the previous chapter or the previous section, but I will not read the bulk of it until the end, because otherwise I just end up tinkering about, and you're just constantly going up against this brick wall of no progress, no momentum. And like you said, it's almost like you just got to free yourself from this shackles of it's going to be the end product at the beginning, which of course it never is. And I always say to people, you know, if you think of a potter's wheel and you get that lump of clay that's thrown on, it takes ages to make it into something that looks beautiful and is exactly what you want it to be. And I think we have to remember that that first attempt is that lump of clay that's just thrown down, and then it can really help to people to realize that it's stages that you go through with writing. And I think people often read books widely and know what they want it to sound like, and when it's not quite sounding like that, you end up going over and over it, but actually remembering that the author on the shelf has been through so many iterations of a draft. And I think that's so important to remember. So yeah, no, that's really useful to hear.
And I think as well that, you know, I now see a book. So I think in the first book, I was like, right, this is me, this is my work, and this is something I must get right. But now I realize that a book is constructed by many people if you're working in the, you know, traditional publishing industry. So actually, yes, it's my work, my name, and I need to be proud of it. But I actually seen it as a kind of construct of many people frees you from that kind of perfect, well, certainly freed me from that perfectionism as well, because, you know, I knew that if I wrote something, it would get changed. So there's no point me spending 10 hours writing two sentences, which did happen a few times in the first book. So I just thought, well, actually, you know, it will get changed anyway. So I love your analogy of the lump of clay. And actually what you do is really clever, because I think when we're in the middle of it, we're so emotionally attached to it. So it's hard to step back and see it as something separate from us and something that we can actually look on more objectively. Whereas if you leave it for a while, I even found writing something and just going back to it maybe a week later, I was like, oh, it's better than I thought. Or I can see which parts I need to cut now because I had space from it. So I think leaving it for a while is a really good thing rather than going back. Because I think in the first pick, I went back over the same chapter again and again. And I've got a bit of that work ethics. I guess you work, you know, in the NHS, you're working constantly. So it was just like, I need to get to the end to get finished. But then the next books, I did start stepping back from it more. And I found that much more freeing as well.
Yeah. How did you feel? I know you said there that when you wrote something, you thought actually it's likely this could be changed. How did you feel about that? Because when I self-publish my nonfiction, so I have an editor, but it's much more of a she suggests that I change things, not she changes things. And I just wonder for you, how are you able to have that disconnect between the thing that you love that you've produced and somebody else saying, actually, no, get rid of that, scrap that? How does that feel as an author?
So I think you can get very attached to certain things and certain parts. And probably when I put something personal down or something really silly, because I can kind of go off on a tangent and think of kind of quite silly analogies and I start chuckling at myself, and I'm probably not even that funny. That's probably the bits I get most attached to. But I think also it's you can get attached to those parts, but what the editor is looking at is how I see it is the overall kind of construct and overall flow. So I've worked with the same editor 3 times now, and I absolutely trust her. So I know, and I think that's such a critical part. I know if she's saying this doesn't quite work here, even though I sat and chuckled with it and really enjoyed writing it, it's probably because I've been writing for 5 hours and I'm really bored, rather than it's a critical part of the book. So I think, you know, I very much trust her to construct something that flows. And I've been attached to individual parts. However, because I also really trust the editor I've worked with and absolutely respect her as an editor, she also, I think her views are suggestions. She says, I've also felt I've had a voice in that. So if I really feel attached to something, I really want in, and I explain something that I think is necessary from a psychology point of view or is kind of ethically required, it always gets put back in. So I think that relationship of trust for me means that I know my viewpoint is trusted, and if I really want to push something, I can. But at the same time, I trust that person to look at the bigger picture, which I sometimes can't look at.
Yeah, that's such a good point. You're right about that point you said around we get so invested in it ourselves, we're so in it that sometimes actually somebody's saying, is that right? Is that relevant? Is it, have you gone off on a tangent? Because I tend to do that around particular topics. If I'm writing about something and something that I love learning about or feel knowledgeable in, I can go off on a tangent. And my editor's great being like, oh, this chapter's longer than all the others. And then she, you know, and I'm like, oh, yes, it's just because I feel like I've got a lot to impart. And she's like, well, either you need to, you know, let's pair it back. This might be a book in itself or something. But she's like, just for the sake of this book, it's really important that we keep everything, you know, and having that person to come in and very kindly challenge. And you're right, it's around the trust and the rapport you have with an editor where you feel like you can really justify certain points that you're like, actually, no, I really want this in, but also at the same point being open-minded and having that mindset of, do you know what, they're probably right here, and not taking offense and just realizing it's part of the process of editing, isn't it, to really just eke out the very best bit.
And I think as well, it's about the relationship you have with people. You've talked about trust with your editor and trust in her opinion. I also have a lot of trust with my editor, and that relationship for me, before I wrote a book, I wouldn't have appreciated how critical it was. But for me now, it is such a critical element of the book to have a team around about you who you trust their opinions. But also it's a two-way relationship, so they trust when you will come back on it. So I think that for me, has been a critical aspect of all my books.
And I just thought now, if you're happy to just touch a little bit on your process and how, with such an exceptionally busy life, you know, say working for the NHS and, you know, doing the work that comes from your books as well, like, I know you go into workplaces and help with mental health and things like that, how do you find time to write?
So I've had 3 very, very different experiences of writing a book. So the first book, like I mentioned, I finished 4 years ago today or thereabouts, and I was working 3 days a week in the NHS. So I had 2 defined days where my children were at school. I wasn't having to juggle anything, where I wrote the book. And that was just, you know, ideal for me. I had these designated times, and sometimes 3 days because I took some annual leave as well, because I was planning for it. So sometimes it was 3 days a week. And I just sat and wrote the book in a quiet house, no distractions. And that now, to me, is a dream. If I could do that again, it would be wonderful. So that worked really, really well. I knew that was my book writing days. I sat down and did it. And I had the whole day if I wanted to, but also I went off and went for walks and thought about it, went and had coffee. So it really was a dream process of writing a book. And then the pandemic hit. And I had two children at home, trying to homeschool them. I was doing, our job changed hugely in the NHS, where we were doing some work from home. I was doing different stuff. I was working on staff wellbeing. It kept on changing. It was less predictable. I also did a lot of different work at that time. So I was working pretty much full time and trying to homeschool. And my husband was working from home. And I had to write in much more protracted periods because I'd say, right, today I'm going to do it. So it was much, rather than I had these 2 or 3 days where I could leisurely go and think about it and pause, I was writing in really protracted periods. So I would sit in one place, my husband would say, right, this is the time, or me and my husband would agree, this is the time I'm going to write with no distractions. And it was really protracted. So I think I had to do it much quicker, much more kind of focused, and I didn't enjoy it so much because it was those pauses which made it much more enjoyable, the stepping back from it, which made it much more enjoyable. It was almost, I have to get it done in this time period and I must do it. And it was very much a product of what was going on with all our lives at the time. And I don't know if I'd had that experience first time, I would have wanted to write another book, but I knew how I really enjoyed the first one, really, really enjoyed it. And that was very much, I still, you know, trusted the team around about me, which I think was critical, but it was very focused. So that was a totally different process, shifting to what was going on. And, you know, I think the end product probably is as good as the first one, but the process was totally different and not as enjoyable, to be quite frank. But also we were in a situation at that time which wasn't enjoyable. So we were doing what we could at the time. There's lots of distractions, even though I was trying to get a distinct period of time. My children would come down and ask me something. Of course they would, because you're there. And I wasn't able to go and sit in coffee shops like I did before. I wrote some of my best chapters in coffee shops the first time. And I'd go out and I'd have, I'm going to sit there for an hour and see what happens. And something would happen. Whereas there was no, I'm just going to wander out because places weren't open. So it was much more focused, much more, I have to do it in this time. And then the third book was totally different again, because we were back. So I was writing that in 2022 and things were opening up again. And I had thought with the pandemic, I would really kind of reevaluate children's activities and what they did. But as soon as things opened up, we thought, let's go and do this again. Let's grab this opportunity. So we were very lucky because I live close to the university here. There's a fantastic sports campus with a swimming pool. And my children would start going back to swimming and they start squash. And I didn't have these periods of time because there was I was working more. I was actually working, I think, 4.5 days a week at that point. So I didn't have these defined days. And I didn't have this kind of nice, or I didn't even have those extended focus periods of time. So most of my book was written in the sports village, as we call it near here. And I wrote it when the children were swimming. I wrote it when they were playing squash. I'd go and sit in the cafe and write it. And it was written in really short bursts of time, which is not my natural way to do it. My natural way was the first time I did it, where I had those pockets of time. It was really enjoyable. But this was focused in a different way, where I knew I had, right, they're in squash for an hour. I will write for an hour. And I had to really give up that perfectionism element, which I certainly did have the first time. And I had to just get something down. And I was the least sociable mum ever at any of these activities. and I actually, it's really strange, I can't really, I signed them up to lots more activities actually so I could get some more time. So they were doing diving and I was sitting writing and drawing, and I must have looked really strange doing this, but and when I'd finished, I was, it's really nice just sit and watch them. And a mum came up to me and went, I've always been wondering, you're sitting like frantically writing every time I see you. What are you doing? And I was like, well, I wrote a book. And I was like, so it was in these tiny periods of time. So it was kind of adapting to the circumstances again. And I probably enjoyed that more than the second one, because it was really defined periods of time and you'd go and do it. You know, you had an hour, but it's probably not my natural way. I like to I feel stressed if I have really confined periods of time. But actually, by the end, I quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, I have never done the first one, the first option, because I wrote my first three when I was still a deputy for all of them? I can't remember, but I was a deputy head for, and I used to get up at 5 a.m. and be like, right, I've got an hour to write, and then I just go to work, and I'd be like, that's, and I've sort of carried that into my practice now, where obviously I don't have the same sort of constraints with time per se, but I found that if I know that I've got an hour and it's the same hour every day for me, because otherwise I just put it off, and I find all these wonderful excuses to do everything else that is not writing. But I feel that, I wonder what I would be like. That's really interesting. It's got me thinking, if I had two whole days, I wonder whether I would be like you, still disciplined, but enjoying that creative time out of, you know, the book, where you're walking or you're doing something else. Sometimes it's just mulling things over and having the space to sort of daydream and think about the different things in a less sort of confined way. So yeah, it's really interesting, but it's really useful, I guess, for you to think, do you know what, I can write in any sort of situation. I think that's quite, because if you found that you just couldn't write at all in either of those scenarios, maybe you would have felt a bit reluctant to be able to do any more. But it's really interesting to see.
And I think as well, there's something about you talking about having almost too much time sometimes, where I think, you know, even though I did have 2 days, it was a very defined period of time from 9 till 3 when I had to pick up my children. So I think probably if I write another book, then I will continue, even if I have more time, which I probably won't, to focus it in some way, say this is my writing time. Probably not as focused as squash lessons and swimming lessons, but yeah, I think what you do actually helps me to hone down and get it down the page. So I'll probably take some of a balance between my first time and my third time, and to maintain focus.
I think that's really helpful for the listeners as well, because often I feel that everybody obviously approaches writing differently, and I'm always saying to people, you have to find what works for you. So, you know, for me, I write at the same time and I have my little writing sprints that I do. But that works for me. And actually, that might feel constraining to other people. And too, like you said, that second book, that when you were writing that, it felt too, almost like too stressful, because you were like, I've only got this and I'm having to do it like this. Whereas for me, I thrive on that sort of thing where I'm like, I've only got half an hour and I'm just going to, you know, and then I write for half an hour and my timer goes and I log my work out and I'm done. And I like that. But I always have to recognize that not everybody is like that. But I think the other point is that people who are wanting to write books, nonfiction, you know, in this sort of space, which is hopefully going to give them opportunities to grow their business, become more well known, they don't have a lot of time often. And I think it's probably very refreshing for them to hear that actually, you know, your two different ways of doing it might fit one, or it might fit some, you know, somebody else in a different way, but that you can still get it done no matter what time you have. You might have a whole day, you might only have an hour. You can still write the thing at the end of it.
And I think we always think, oh, if I had more time, this would be better. And that ties into that perfectionist element. I would totally dispute that now. I think actually you can produce a good book in a short or period of time, and it's just as good as, you know, if you had all the time in the world. In fact, it might even be better, because you can get really focused on it.
I wonder whether you wouldn't mind if we just had a little chat about at sort of opportunities and things that have arisen from writing, because I got to know you through my subscription to Psychology's magazine, and your sort of column at the back of Psychology's, and I was sort of, yeah, you know, I was reading it every month, and I was thinking, I'd loved everything you were doing, and I just loved, you know, the illustrations and everything, and then when I realized that we were following each other on Instagram, I have to say to you right now, I said to my husband, I was like, look at this lady who writes this column. She's following me on Instagram.
That's because I find your stuff really helpful.
Yeah. But it was just, you know, it's those sort of things that are just like, oh, wow. And then when I was like, I have to have you on the podcast because, you know, I love what you do. And I just think it would be really helpful for people to know sort of what things have come about off the back of your publishing journey.
Sure. So, and I think that as a psychologist having a book, and I'm, you know, really proud of the books, but so many things which I didn't expect have come from it. And that's been really positive in some ways. I'll go into some of the positive things, but also it has, I have to say, been a bit of a stress, because when I first wrote a book, I didn't expect any of this. And there was so much stuff coming my way that I didn't know. It all looked amazing because having worked for the NHS for 20 years, we never get a single freebie or you never get, you know, it's really quite a lot of the time, you know, really positive work, but a lot of it's very stressful. Suddenly all these really interesting things were coming my way and I had no way to discern kind of what I should and shouldn't do or what I even enjoyed doing and what I wanted to do. So I probably did everything and it probably wasn't helpful. So I think, you know, just really think about what you enjoy doing or what's meaningful to you and what's of value to you. Because I don't think that was beneficial to me. So I got asked for a lot of press quotes for articles. I got asked to go on a lot of podcasts. I got asked to do talks, a lot of really interesting talks. I got asked to do pieces of work for various organizations, some illustrations, some talks. I got asked to talk at book festivals. Now, that all seemed really exciting to me. And I probably didn't turn down hardly any opportunities because I didn't expect them to come along. And I didn't know how long it would last for. That wasn't helpful. That probably added to my stress far too much. So some of the really positive things that come from it are the column in Psychology's magazine. I had an interview with, or I did a talk with the Sunday Telegraph. And I actually thought, and this is very unlike me, I thought, I'm just going to grab this opportunity to ask if they'd be interested in me writing a column for them. And nothing came of it. And a few months later, they got back in touch and said, oh, we'd love you to write a column. So I wrote a winter column and did illustrations of wellbeing. Now, that is very unlike me, but I've got better at just thinking, right, I'm speaking to this person. Maybe there's an opportunity. Could we link this together? And it might not happen, but it might, you know, it might happen at some point in the future. I went on some really brilliant podcasts. One I remember was with Nell Frizzell, who's an author who writes books about parenthood. And she had a very well-known comedian on the same podcast, and she was recorded at different times. I can't even remember who it is. It's a person who presents the Great British Sewing Bee. She's really cool. So she wasn't on at the same time, but she was you know, on the podcast. And HuffPost got in touch to do a video. Lots of people were sharing my work. So it was just, it kind of took me aback. And I guess because my work's quite illustrative, that made it easier to share. But as I said, you know, lots of interesting opportunities, but too many, if I'm totally honest. And by the third book, I had more of a sense of what works for me. What do I enjoy doing? What do I connect with? And I've probably had less opportunities come out of it, but I've really enjoyed most of them. So, you know, going to a wonderful book festival in the Borders where my children came along and they were sitting with Rory Bremner and John Coolshaw playing a game of chess with them, which, you know, I would never expect to happen. And I had a lovely event, which it still surprised me. It sold out. And I'm still like, oh, wow, you know, people want to come and hear me speak. So but I'm much more able to say, yes, I want to do that, or no, I don't want to do that. And obviously the publisher is good in kind of thinking about what would work. I don't do everything through them, but and a lot of radio work as well, a lot of requests to go on radio shows, and I kind of know a lot of people now, but also have a lot of connections. So somebody from 2 years ago now might get in touch with me to say, would you do this or would you do that? So a lot of really nice connections who I kind of stay in touch with. So for example, I presented at, this is a really funny one, but a really enjoyable one. I presented at a book festival in London, and the presenter of that is Leah Belletto, who at the time was on the children's news programme on BBC. And her husband, I think, both presented that. And she was just lovely. And I've kept in touch with her. And she was presented, this is the most random opportunity, it's not an opportunity, but the random thing ever that's come from it. She was presenting on the Neighbours show that was going around Britain. And I just got in touch and said, oh my goodness, dream job. Yeah, I love Neighbours. And she was like, why don't you come along to one of the shows? So like, it was brilliant. So I've kept in touch with a lot of people and because I really liked them. And that's kind of led to fun things, interesting things. My advice would be, you know, in a non-fiction world, as a psychologist or an expert, there'll probably be quite a few things come your way, but don't feel you have to do all of them. It probably made me burn out a bit because it was also in the middle of a pandemic. Just really stop and think, which ones you want to do and what's important to you.
That's such sound advice, honestly, because I think we can, I always say to people when we talk, you know, it might be their first book, and I always try and get them to think about what you want out of this. What do you want the book to do for you? Because there's no point in writing it just for the sake of writing. You've got to think, like, you know, what opportunities would you like? And they won't, like you said, not everything comes about the way you think it will, but actually, what do you want the book to be able to help you to do? And it's such an important thing to consider that sometimes there are going to be loads of opportunities. And I know that, like you said, that's so exciting when it's your first book and you're thinking, I've just got to say yes to everything. But I love the point you made around choosing what are the things that actually really feel aligned with you and make you feel happy and excited. And what are the things that maybe you feel like you should do or you have to do, and actually being more mindful in your choices around what you say yes and no to. And I think that's such great advice. So thank you for sharing that. And that perspective is very refreshing.
And I think for me, if I can come back with one thing around that, how I did that was connecting to why did I write the book in the first place? I wrote it to make psychology and mental health and brain information more accessible. I wrote it to connect to people so they could find it beneficial and use it in their everyday lives. So I then started thinking, does this opportunity enable me to do that? So does it connect to my why of writing this book? And, you know, creating that community, improving people's well-being, be able to explain mental health and well-being. So that's what for me really helped me think, will I do this or not?
That's really helpful. And actually, I was about to come to my very last question, which was, what advice would you give an aspiring author who's about to start on their writing journey? And I feel like that's a really good one that, you know, could answer that question. But is there anything else that you feel like immediately leaps out at you when I ask that one piece of advice type of question? Is there something that sticks out for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've probably touched on it already, but I think it's releasing yourself from that perfection. And I was very much tied into that with my first book. Oh, I must get this right before I show anybody anything. And I think just saying, some of what I write will be rubbish, you know, it won't all be good. But actually, that's okay, because even something that isn't so good in the first place can become great after I look at it again. But also, what I feel is rubbish often isn't rubbish. It just happens something down the page rather than thinking you must get right is better. And also remembering that book is shaped by a range of people, including your editor. And that's really beneficial, I think, or very freeing for me to think, right, even if it is rubbish, which it might be at some points, somebody's going to pick up on it and it won't be by the end product. I'll be able to change this. I'll be able to go back to it. Somebody else will cast eyes on it. So free yourself from that has to be perfect.
Oh my gosh, yes, yes. I hear you loud and clear, and I absolutely champion that too. I think that's a really lovely way to end it. Now, I have my very final question is, are there any other books in the pipeline?
Oh, well, I'm doing some research at the moment on, again, I think I could only write a book that's really meaningful to me. So there's been a few ideas that I've just not connected with, but I have an idea at the moment that I've really connected with. And it's probably going to be a bit different if I do write it. It probably won't be so illustrated and probably have more of my personal experience in it, some of which I've touched on through this. So possibly just under consideration at the moment. But, you know, yeah. So one of the things that did happen, and I guess I missed this, is opportunities in the book. Some of my illustrations have been made into products. So that's been really nice as well. And so I've made cards from our emotional first aid kit, which includes my writing and the image. So also looking at doing some more of that, what kind of other products could we create from this that has the same beneficial impact, actually enables people to use them even more in their life?
Yeah. Oh, and they are so shareable and so... and also so giftable, I think. Whenever I see, they're the types of things I'd love to see, like on a postcard or on a poster or something that's just up that can help people out. So, oh, wow. Well, good luck with that. That sounds really exciting. And it's been an absolute privilege and an absolute joy to have you on today. So thank you for giving up your time.
Thank you.
So there you have it. That was my conversation with the wonderful Dr. Emma Hepburn. And what an inspirational conversation it was. She is just so warm and lovely. And we had such a great chat after we stopped recording as well and found out so much more about each other's writing habits and our own publishing ambitions. It was just lovely to get to know her better. I will link to all her social media handles in the show notes and also to her website where you can find her books. I do encourage you to go and head on over to @thepsychologymum on Instagram, because her illustrations are just incredible. A big thank you to Emma for her time and her wonderful expertise and knowledge around the writing process in this episode. If you know someone else who would enjoy it, why don't you forward it to them, share it with them, and let them know that it's worth listening to, especially if they are thinking of going down the traditional publishing route and they need a touch of motivation. If you haven't yet already left a review, I'd really, really love it if you could on your favourite podcast platform. But until next time, my love, happy, happy writing.